the second section from chapter 7 to chapter 12 is, it's like the heart of Bhagavad Gita. It's the most important section of Bhagavad Gita, and in it Lord Krishna is describing very clearly the process of devotional service and revealing himself to be the object of devotional service, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's a very nice section. We just read at the end of our class yesterday how the last two verses of the sixth chapter, they sum up all of the first six chapters, actually, that whole first six section, first section. That first section, chapters 1 to 6, was dealing with mainly yoga, different types of yoga, but particularly karma yoga. But in a general sense, it was reviewing the main systems of yoga presented in the Vedas. Of course, there are so many systems of yoga, and Krishna didn't discuss all of them, but the systems that he did discuss, they are the main systems of yoga. Jnana yoga, karma yoga, ashtanga yoga, and finally bhakti yoga. These four systems of yoga, they're the main systems of yoga according to the Vedic scriptures. So, to summarize and conclude that first section of chapter 1 to chapter 6, Krishna in the second to last verse, verse 46, of chapter 6. He pointed out that out of all types of people, particularly he refers to four types of people, the yogis, then the ascetics. Ascetic basically means one who may engage in Ashtanga yoga, a very renounced process, as we were reading yesterday, going up to the mountains and meditating like that. So the ascetic, the Ashtanga yogi, the empiricist, that basically refers to the jnana yogi, and the fruit of worker. Fruit of worker, that term can refer either to the karma kandiya type of person or the karma yogi, because they're both dealing in the activities of fruit of work, karma, the activity of the material body. So, anyway, Krishna is saying that a yogi is better than an ascetic, an empiricist, and a fruit of worker. Now, in the last verse, verse 47, Krishna then states that out of the different types of yogis, which yogi is the best, or which system of yoga is the best? And he makes it very clear, madgatena antaratmana, that topmost yogi has to make Krishna the goal of his yoga practice. And shradavan bhajate yo mam, the activities of that topmost yogi, they must involve bhajate, which we described yesterday as not meaning simply to worship, but, as Śrī Prabhupāda describes at some length in the purport of this verse, 47, that the term bhaj, from which we get the word bhajate, or bhajan, or bhakti, or bhakta, like this. This word, this root, bhaj, it actually means to dedicate one's life to serving Krishna in a mood of devotion. Not just that on Sunday you visit the temple, but then you carry on with your other activities at other times. But actually that one dedicates one's life to devotional service, to Krishna. Bhajate yo mam. Not someone else, not some other deity, but Krishna. So, same yukta tamo mataha. This yogi is the best yogi. Of all different types of people, the yogis are the best. And of all the yogis, the bhakti yogi is the best. or in other words, bhakti yoga, is the best of all the different types of yoga. And it's actually the highest activity for human beings. So that concludes the first section of Bhagavad Gita, chapters 1 to 6. Then we go on to chapter 7. And in verse 1 is very important verse. Kavi Chandra Maharaj mentioned this morning in class, I don't know if you caught it, that of all verses in Bhagavad Gita, in Srimad Bhagavatam, of all verses in any scripture, this particular verse, chapter 7, verse 1 of Bhagavad Gita, is the verse that Srila Prabhupada lectured on most, which definitely says something about this verse. If you look in the compilation books of Prabhupada's lectures on Bhagavad Gita, you'll see that this verse is lectured on, at least there are recordings of lectures, something like at least 20, there's actually a little bit more than 20, or maybe 23 or 24, something like that. So Prabhupada chose this verse very frequently, actually. And any of you remember which verse was the verse that Prabhupada lectured on the second most? Yes, chapter 2, verse 13. That verse, there's something like 12 or 13 or 14 lectures on, something like that. So this says something, it definitely says something about this verse. So the basic idea in this verse, verse 1 of the 7th chapter, it's the first verse of this most important section of Bhagavad Gita. So Krishna here is summarizing what is this best yoga. The best yoga is bhakti yoga. So what is the nature of it? This verse is giving a brief but concise and precise statement of what is the essential nature of bhakti yoga. So we're going to ask you this as one of the questions in the test, to explain these three verses, the two last verses of chapter 6 and the first verse of chapter 7. Explain the basic philosophical points made. So this verse then, verse 1 of chapter 7, contains like the essential nature, describes the essential nature of bhakti yoga. So first of all, maya sakta mana, that one's mind must be attached to Krishna. That is Krishna consciousness. Krishna, the term Krishna consciousness means to be conscious of Krishna. So, and conscious of Krishna means that you have to be thinking of Krishna, or your mind has to be attached to Krishna. If you're not thinking of Krishna, you're thinking of some other thing, then how can you say that you're Krishna conscious? You're obviously not. So Krishna consciousness as a term means maya sakta mana, that your mind has to be attached to Krishna. And then yogam yunjam madashraya, that one performs the activities of this type of yoga, bhakti yoga, under the shelter of Krishna. Under the shelter of Krishna, depending on Krishna, and engaging wholeheartedly in the activities, which means dedicating one's whole life to performing so many activities for the pleasure of Krishna. So, what will be the effect of that? Asamshayam samagram ma. Samshaya means doubt. In material life we have so many doubts about so many things, and when we take up Krishna consciousness, we also have so many doubts. But if you stick at the process and practice it in this way, then Krishna says, asamshayam samagram. Samshaya means doubt, asamshaya means without doubt, and samagram means completely. So Krishna is making a very clear, very strong statement, very emphatic statement, that if you do like this, you'll become completely free of doubt. In other words, you'll be completely delivered from Maya. Doubt means Maya. You'll be completely delivered from Maya. And how do you do that? Touch Trinu. You have to hear. Krishna is telling Arjuna that you have to hear from me. So we have to hear from Krishna. Bhagavad Gita, we have to hear from Krishna's devotees. This is how you can achieve this very nice position of being fixed in Bhakti Yoga, which is the best of all systems of yoga. So that's a little introduction. Now, the first section of chapter 7 is from verse 1 to verse 3. So we've just discussed verse 1. The idea is that our minds, first of all, have to be attached to Krishna. Without your mind being attached to Krishna, there's no question of Bhakti Yoga. There's no question of Krishna consciousness. So, how are we going to do this? So, in verse 2, Krishna gives the basic idea. He says, now I'm going to describe to you all the knowledge you'll need in order to achieve this state. This knowledge, both phenomenal and numinous. Phenomenal means, actually, Ramanujacharya describes that when Krishna uses the term phenomenal, or in Sanskrit, it's jnanam, then what he's referring to is knowledge about the material realm, but with Krishna as the background. In other words, how everything in this material world is related to Krishna. So that'll help us to become Maya Sakta Mana, get our minds attached to Krishna, because then wherever we look in the material world, we'll understand, oh yes, this is a manifestation of Krishna, or Krishna is in the background here. So that's jnanam, or phenomenal knowledge, knowledge about this world in relation to Krishna. And then numinous. Well, quite frankly, I don't even know what the word numinous means, what a dictionary sort of translation into common English would be. It's a rather obscure word. But the Sanskrit term is vijnanam, and what we understand by this term, numinous or vijnanam, at least in this context, is knowledge about Krishna himself in person. Ramanujacharya, he says that this term vijnanam means knowledge about Krishna, his form, his pastimes, his activities. So one, the phenomenal knowledge, that's knowledge of the material world with Krishna as the background, and then the numinous, or the vijnanam, that type of knowledge, means knowledge about Krishna directly. So Krishna is going to reveal all this, and if we listen nicely, if Arjuna listens very nicely, then he will achieve the state of Maya Sakta Mana, his mind being attached to Krishna, or in other words, being Krishna conscious. Verse 3, Krishna makes the point that this is very nice, but it's quite rarely achieved. It's not that everyone, it's not even that, you know, a significant percentage of the people may achieve this. It's actually very rare. When Krishna says that out of many thousands among men, one may endeavor for perfection, that perfection that Krishna is talking about here is Brahman realization. Prabhupada explains that in one lecture. When Krishna here says, out of many thousands among men, one may endeavor for perfection, that perfection is Brahman realization, spiritual realization. And out of those people, those who have achieved that spiritual level, come to the spiritual platform, hardly one of them really knows Krishna, or hardly one of them is Krishna conscious. So it's very rare. That point comes up in this chapter. Verse 19. Any of you know what is chapter 7, verse 19? Yes. Bahunam janmanamante gyanavanmam prapajate vasudeva saravamiti samahatma sudurlabha. Any of you not familiar, to say? Samahatma sudurlabha, such a great soul who really understands Krishna or really surrenders to Krishna is very rare. And then again in verse 26 of this chapter, any of you know chapter 7, verse 26? It's not as well known. Drista, brother. Very good. Krishna says that, as the Supreme Lord, I know everything that's happened in the past, everything that's happening now in the present, everything that's going to happen in the future. I also know all the living beings, all of them. But me, no one knows. So it's rare, it's very rare that someone really comes to understand Krishna and know Krishna. Now, the second section, starting with verse 4, going from verse 4 to verse 12, Krishna gives some of this knowledge about himself, how he's the background of material existence, even a little bit about his personality. Anyone not signed themselves present? Pass it back to Dr. James. So he begins giving some of this knowledge to help us get our minds attached to him. So what does he say first of all? First of all, in verses 4 and 5, he gives a very broad description. Very broad. In verse 4, he describes how he is the background to everything material. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, false ego. You don't find anything else in the material world than these eight elements. And what are these eight elements, Krishna says? They are my separated energies. So here in one verse, he's given at least the basic principle that wherever you look in this material world, wherever you see anything material, you know, this is my energy. So then you can relate that to Krishna. Then verse 5, he talks about everything else, everything spiritual. That besides the material elements, there's another nature which is spiritual. And it includes the jivas. He's actually referring not only really to the jivas, but actually to the entire swarup shakti, or the entire spiritual energy, which the whole spiritual realm is made up of, and the jivas. So here in these first two verses, Krishna has, at least in simple terms and in very broad terms, described everything in existence. The material world, the spiritual world, and the jivas. These three shaktis, internal, external, and marginal. And given us the basic idea through which we can connect these things with Krishna. And in this way, achieve maya sakta mana. In verse 6 and 7, he basically makes the same point. They're the living beings, there's the material energy, there's the spiritual energy, and I'm both the origin and dissolution. In all cases, there's no question of anything being independent of me. And verse 8, again a very strong statement, there's no truth superior to me. Everything rests on me as pearls are strung on a thread. This example that Krishna is giving of the pearls strung on a thread is a very nice example. When you see pearls strung on a thread, they look very nice, very orderly, and very attractive looking. But you don't see the thread. Now if you think that, oh look, there are these pearls, and these pearls are just hanging there of their own accord, because you can't see the thread. then obviously you're not understanding how that arrangement is actually there. That arrangement is there because there's a thread. If there was no thread, then the pearls, you know, wouldn't be a nice arrangement. It'd just be a mess. So, everything, this material realm and the spiritual realm also for that matter, the very nice arrangements we see, they're only there because Krishna is there. If it wasn't for Krishna's presence, well, it wouldn't be like this at all. But we can't see Krishna. People can't see Krishna, so they think, oh, there's no Krishna. It's just matter. Matter has sort of organized itself into this material world, somehow or other, evolution and all that. So this is all because they can't see the string there in the thread. They can't see that the background to this nice arrangement is Krishna. Then, starting with verse 8 to verse 11, Krishna gives some specific examples, like specific details, of certain specific features, mainly of this material world. And they're very important features. Like, first of all, he says, I'm the taste of water. So in this material world, everything is being sustained by water. He's the light of the sun. Everything is being sustained by water, but it's also being sustained by the light of the sun. And the moon. Vegetables and eatables are being given their flavor somehow by the moon. So he's referring to, having referred to the whole material nature and also the whole spiritual nature, now he's referring to certain very important features of the material nature. I'm the taste of water. Srila Prabhupada said that every time you drink water, if you pick up on this idea, you drink water and you can think, oh yes, Krishna's the taste of water. So it'll remind you of Krishna. You see the sun, you think, oh yes, this light is Krishna, or it's coming from Krishna. So you can be Krishna conscious. Prabhupada said that even, as far as the taste of water is concerned, even an alcoholic, a wino, he drinks his wine. Prabhupada said, even if he thinks that, oh yes, the taste of this wine is Krishna, then eventually he'll become Krishna conscious also. So to see how powerful it is to, if you associate everything with Krishna, understand how Krishna is the background of everything. Krishna says, I'm the syllable Om in the Vedic mantras. Of all the Vedic mantras, this Om, Omkar, is the most important mantra. I'm the sound in ether. Sound is very important. I'm the ability in man. Man is like the predominant species in the universe. And Krishna is the ability in man. So these are all very important features of the material nature. I'm the original fragrance of the earth. Bhuri Jan Prabhu, I think it was, gave the example of a rose or any fragrant flower. It smells very nice. But where is the fragrance coming from? There's the seed. If you plant the seed of a rose, put it in the ground and water it, then eventually the plant comes and the flower comes and the flower smells very nice. So where did the smell come from? It didn't come from the water. When you water the plant, because water has no smell, it didn't come from the seed. If you open up the seed, you'll see it doesn't smell like anything in particular. So where did the smell come from? It didn't come from nowhere. It came from the earth. So the earth is like the reservoir of all fragrances, of all smells. And Krishna, that original fragrance is Krishna. He's the heat and fire, the life of all that lives, the penances of all ascetics, the original seed of all existences, the intelligence of the intelligent. sex life which is not contrary to religious principles. So these are all very important features of life in this material world. And Krishna is here helping us to relate those to him. Then verse 12 is very interesting. In verse 12, Krishna speaks achintya bheda bheda tattva philosophy. Sometimes we think that this philosophy of achintya bheda bheda tattva, simultaneous one and difference, that this was created by Lord Chaitanya, but that's not a fact. Lord Chaitanya certainly stressed it and really put it out in the front and gave it a very prominent position. But the philosophy of achintya bheda bheda tattva is like the essential principle of Krishna conscious philosophy eternally. Everything is one with and simultaneously different from Krishna, inconceivably. Know that all states of being, of goodness, passion, or ignorance, are manifested by my energy. I'm in one sense everything, but then again I'm independent. Bade abade, or abade bade, different from and not different from. I'm not under the modes. Actually, they're under me. So here he refers to the three modes. They're under him. Now, of course, we should also bear in mind that when Krishna says that I am this and I am that, it's not exactly that those particular things are Krishna in person. No, as he says here in verse 12, they are manifested by my energy. But energy is one and different from Krishna. So in one sense, you can say that Krishna's energy is Krishna. Although it's not exactly Krishna, at least in the sense of Krishna in person. But you can't say that it's simply not Krishna at all. So, Krishna says, I'm the taste and water. It doesn't mean that it's like you're actually drinking the form of Krishna. But it is Krishna's energy, and because it's inseparable from him, we can see it as being like a part of him, in one sense. Section C. The first verse, 13, explains about how conditioned souls are deluded. Krishna isn't deluded by the modes, according to verse 12, but unfortunately we are. And because we are deluded by the modes, we don't understand him as he is. That's why he has to give us all this help, to help us to become conscious of him properly. So how do we do that? Verse 14 explains very nicely. Actually, the material energy is extremely difficult to overcome. We mentioned the other day that one name of Durga is Rudrani, one who can make you cry forever. And Prabhupada also explained that Maya Devi, has no morality. She may beat you down, smash you down. She does that rather frequently. So she gives you a good boot and you get knocked over and you wonder what's going on. But then she doesn't stand back and say, oh, poor fellow, better let him stand up again. No, she immediately jumps in. She says, oh, good, I've got him down. Now I can really smash him. So Maya has no morality. And she's Rudrani. She can make you cry forever. So it's so difficult to get out of Maya. But how do you do it? Krishna says, Mam Eviye Prapajyante, Maya Metam Tarantite. You just surrender to me, then you can easily cross over this ocean of the three modes. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur makes a very nice point about this particular verse. Krishna is saying, Mam Eva Ye Prapajyante. Mam Prapajyante means, if you surrender to me. Eva means certainly, definitely. So Krishna is saying that if you surrender to me, then definitely you can get out of this Maya. So according to Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, when Krishna makes this statement, he, with his point, what they sometimes call pointing finger, he points, he says, Mam Eva Ye Prapajyante. like that. Emphatically. You just surrender to me and you'll easily cross over. He just goes through his life just maintaining on the most simple level. So he's muddha, like an ass, just working as required. Second is Naradama. Prabhupada translates that as the lowest amongst mankind. Their characteristic is that they're extremely ambitious materially. They're the big businessmen, the big politicians, the big material exploiters that the mudhas normally get taken advantage of by. Yeah, like the big businessmen, big politicians, they're trying to make as much as they can, take advantage of the position in this material world, and they don't care. They don't care about their workers, they don't care about the public or the ecology or the environment or anything. They just care about getting ahead materially. I read once that one big company, big like corporation in America, they wrote one of their analysts or whatever, wrote a report once about how you can speed up things on the production line. If you have a complex production line where there are many people, and if one of the people is missing, the whole production line breaks down. So he wrote a paper on how, if one person who's on the production line dies on the job, he's there working his machine, suddenly he drops dead, how you can get him out of the way as quickly as possible and move another worker in as quickly as possible so you don't lose your profits. So they're like that. They treat their workers just like cattle or even less, just like parts in a machine that you can throw away and replace if the need arises. So they are Naradamas, the lowest among mankind. Nasty people. Then Mayaya Parita Jnana. Those whose knowledge is stolen by illusion. They are very intelligent. They have knowledge. But that knowledge is stolen by illusion. Like the material intellectuals. Materialistic philosophers and writers and poets and people like that. They're very intelligent. And they're very perceptive. But it's all stolen by Maya. They don't understand that behind all these things that they're talking about and describing is Krishna. And then last class, Asura, the demons. Demon means specifically someone who doesn't like Krishna. That is the definition of a demon. Now, not these Naradamas. They're not necessarily demons. At least in like the strict sense of the term. Demon, it's the Sanskrit term is asura. Asura. Sura means godly. Asura means ungodly. So it specifically refers to their attitude towards God. Not just that they're big materialists or they're, you know, they don't mind hurting other people or like that. But specifically that they don't like God. So, they are the asuras. And the worst of them are the Mayavadis. Because they say that they hate Krishna. They hate Krishna. They say Krishna has no arms. That means he's a cripple. Krishna has no intelligence. That means he's a fool. Like that. Krishna has no eyes. That means he's blind. So they're attacking him personally. This makes them demons. Then in verse 16, Krishna talks about four kinds of people who do surrender. Not exactly that they do, but they may. They may surrender. The distressed, the desire of wealth, the inquisitive, and those who are specifically interested in understanding the absolute truth. You know, when people, if there's a big disaster like this earthquake recently in this country, or if there's a big war or something, people suddenly become very religious. Very religious. Suddenly the churches and temples and everything are packed. But as soon as the problem's over, then you notice that the people are not coming. So in distress, people may turn to God. Of course, if they're not a little pious, Krishna says here, four kinds of pious men render service. So if they're not at least a little pious, then in their distress, rather than turn to God, they may turn to intoxication. They may turn to politics, like anarchy or communism or something like that. They may just go mad. But if they're pious, they may turn to God. Then the desire of wealth, people who want money, they're very fond of praying to God, give me this, give me that, give us this day our daily bread, give me a house and a car and a color TV, Om Jai Jagadisha Hare, and all these ideas. And then the inquisitor, they hear that yes, there's Krishna and Krishna's like this and like that, and they think, oh really, sounds interesting, let me look into this. So they're a little curious. And then those who really want to know, they really want to understand what is life, who is God, what does it all mean. So these are the four categories. Now, in verse 17, Krishna explains that of those four categories, the last category, those who are really in search of knowledge, they are the best. Because their main interest is just that, to know God. Whereas the desire, the distressed or desire of wealth, particularly, once they get from God whatever they're asking from Him, then they may very well say, thank you, God. When I need some more money or when I get into distress again, I'll come back to you. But for the time being, see you later. Like that. That is their tendency. When they're distressed or when they're in need of something, oh yes, they'll turn to God. But once they've got it, then that impetus for turning to God is not there. So, in their cases, there's a distinct likelihood that even though they may turn to God, that once the problem or whatever it is they're turning to Him for, once that is dealt with, that they may then turn away from Him. Now the inquisitive person is a little better. He's definitely a bit better. Because he actually has an interest to know, who is this God? What does it mean? What is it all about? But there's also a problem there. It's not that he's really dedicated, that he must know. It's just like some maybe casual interest or something like that. So after he's found out that, oh yes, Krishna's like this and Krishna's like that, he may say, well, very good. Now let me find out about something else. So then he may lose interest in Krishna and go on to some other subject. But he who is searching for knowledge of God, when he comes to knowledge of Krishna consciousness, then it's very, very likely that he will accept it and dedicate himself to that knowledge and to following, executing the meaning, the goal of that knowledge. So he's best, Krishna says. And in 18, Krishna says, of course, they're all very nice. They're all great souls. But the Jnana Bhakta, he is like me, or I consider him to be just like me. He is as dear to me as I am. And he's sure to come to me. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur makes a very interesting comment here. He says that Krishna says, Krishna is speaking, that this Jnana Bhakta is like my own body or self. I consider him to be like my own body, like my own self. He's more dear to me than Lord Shiva is. He's more dear to me than Lord Balaram. He's more dear to me than Pradyumna or even Rukmini. But, this is a very interesting point, although this pure devotee, this Jnana Bhakta, is as dear to me as I am to me. Still, my Prema Bhakta, is more dear to me than I am to me. So just consider. The Prema Bhakta is more dear to Krishna than Krishna is to himself. That's why, if you please the devotees, particularly those who are on this high level, that this is the best way of pleasing Krishna. And at the same time, if you displease those devotees, that's much more displeasing to Krishna than if you displease Krishna directly. Or as Jiva Goswami says in Bhakti Sandarbha, that pleasing the devotees, serving the devotees, is a more effective way of developing love of God than trying to develop love of God. If you follow that. Nice statement. Serving the devotees is a more effective way of developing love of God than trying to develop love of God. So anyway, here we're talking about the Jnana Bhakta specifically. So he is definitely quite an extraordinary person. So the idea is that the other three classes, the distressed, the desire of wealth, and also the inquisitive, they really have to come to this level of being Jnana Bhaktas, being fixed in knowledge of Krishna and convinced, and on the basis of that conviction, then engaging in devotional service. If their position in Krishna consciousness is to really be secure. And then in 19, Krishna explains that this Jnana Bhakta, after many, many births and deaths, the Jnana Bhakta will finally completely surrender to me, because on the basis of his knowledge, he'll understand my position as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he's a very rare person. But the Prema Bhakta, this will come across, well, in different places, but particularly in chapter 12. Krishna says that his devotee, and there he's referring to as Prema Bhakta, that I am the swift deliverer of my devotee. Swift deliverer. Not many births and many deaths, no. Even in one lifetime. You may have heard, some of you have heard, one devotee asked Prabhupada once, that you say that all we have to do is chant 16 rounds a day and follow the regulative principles and engage in our service. And at the end of this life, we'll go back to Godhead. Prabhupada said, yes, that's true. The devotee said that, you know, Srila Prabhupada, it sounds too easy. It sounds too easy. Can it really be that easy? You just chant your rounds, follow the principles, do your service, and you go back to Godhead? I don't think it can really be that easy. And Prabhupada said a very profound thing. Prabhupada said, do you think that I would cheat you? So, it's like that. If you follow Prabhupada, who's certainly a Prema Bhakta, by his mercy you can also get Prema, and then you can easily attain the lotus feet of Krishna. But the Jnana Bhakta, one who's, Jnana Bhakta means that there's some attachment to just to like philosophy and these ideas. For one who's on that level, who doesn't really come to the level of Prema Bhakta, they'll come to Krishna, they'll come, but it'll take a long time. Anyway, here we're talking about these four classes, so that's is what Krishna is discussing here at this point. So the next section is discussing two types of people. Two types of people who don't surrender to Krishna. They're not successful in achieving the goal of life. They're not actually included in the four categories. I mean, one of them may be, or they all may be, but they're not specifically referred to. There are two special categories. They are the demigod worshippers and the impersonalists. Of course, the impersonalists fall into the category of the asuras. Anyway, Krishna takes these two categories and specifically describes them. So verse 20, if any of you are preaching to Indian people, then verse 20 and 21 22 and 23. They're very relevant if you're preaching to Indian people. People are into demigod worship. Krishna completely smashes the idea of demigod worship. People who are pratijnana, they're deprived of knowledge, small intelligence. They worship demigods. They select a particular demigod, the one who's supplying the particular thing they want. If it's money they want, they choose Lakshmi. If it's knowledge they want, they choose Saraswati or whatever it may be. Like the inhabitants of Vrindavan, they chose Indra because they wanted rain for their agricultural activities. So people select according to their desires. They select a suitable demigod and then follow the particular process of worship recommended for that demigod. But they're fools. They're not intelligent. Anyway, Krishna says in verses 20 and 21 that I help them as the super soul. But, just like we're saying about the threads hanging on the string, whatever benefit they get from that demigod is coming from me, Krishna says. But because they're less intelligent, they don't understand it's me. They think it's just the demigod. So, later on in the ninth chapter, there's a few more verses specifically addressing demigod worship. And there Krishna says that they're worshipping Avidipurvakam in a wrong way. What they're doing is wrong. 23 is very explicit. These demigod worshippers are Alpamedasam, small intelligence. The goals they achieve are very small, not particularly worthwhile. But my devotees, they achieve my supreme abode, my eternal abode. So they are very intelligent. Then 24 and 25 are discussing the impersonalists. Impersonalists, Mayavadis, like that. Brahmavadis. So in verse 24, Krishna defeats what is one of the main points of Shankaracharya. Of course, Shankaracharya hadn't taken birth at that time. But Krishna in Bhagavad Gita is practically dealing with all philosophies. So he says that some people, these impersonalists, they think that I was impersonal before. In other words, that I'm some unusual manifestation of the Brahmajyoti, the impersonal Brahman. Somehow the impersonal Brahman has manifested as me. And now I'm existing here for the time being, but after some time, I'll go back to my position as being the impersonal Brahman. So in other words, some people think that I've assumed this form and personality. Actually, in my natural state, I don't have a form, I don't have a personality. But now I've assumed a form and personality just to help the conditioned souls so they can relate to the absolute truth in the form of me, Krishna. But actually, this form, Krishna, is not really the absolute truth. The absolute truth is impersonal. So Krishna says that these people who think like this, they are Abhudaya. The demigod worshippers, Krishna said, are Alpamedasa. They have small intelligence. Now the impersonalists, they are Abhudaya. Abhudaya literally means they have no brain. Literally, it means no intelligence. So they're even worse. And due to their small knowledge, they don't understand what is the real transcendental science of spiritual philosophy of the absolute truth. And verse 25, Krishna says that all these foolish people, demigod worshippers, impersonalists, whatever, I hide myself from them. In other words, you can't force your way into the presence of the Supreme Lord. You can't demand that, God, you appear to me right now. otherwise I won't believe in you. I mean, you can try that, but Krishna will not be impressed. Krishna will say, well, if you don't want to believe in me, that's your problem. But for Krishna, it's no problem. So he doesn't bother. He doesn't bother with these people. But he does bother with the sincere people who are, even though they're not qualified, but at least they're basically sincere and they're trying to approach him. Krishna helps those people. So now, the last section, verse 26 to 30. In verses 26 and 27, Krishna is really contrasting his position to our position. We already looked at verse 26 a little bit. Krishna is explaining how great he is as the Supreme Lord. He knows everything, past, present, future, all living beings. There's nothing outside of his knowledge. But we don't know him. And according to verse 27, practically we don't know anything. We're deluded. We don't even, what to speak of not knowing Krishna, we don't even know ourselves. And we're overwhelmed by dualities. All different types of dualities in terms of the particular body we have. If you have one body, your dualities will be different from if you have another body. Like, if you're a human being, you may be in the duality, should I eat meat or vegetables? But the animals and the vegetables, they are in different dualities, and they don't appreciate. I'm sure they don't appreciate very much being part of your duality. So their duality and your duality are different. So according to your particular position, you'll have certain dualities which are your duality is under those circumstances. And when you change your body, you'll have different dualities. But you'll always be in duality. Good, bad. Like, as far as meat-eating and vegetarianism go, people say meat-eating is bad, vegetarianism is good. So vegetarianism may, from one angle of vision, be better than meat-eating. But vegetarianism is not very good for the vegetables. So you can't really say that vegetarianism is simply good. No, it's a question of duality, relative dualities, according to your position. So that is the very unfortunate condition of the conditioned souls. They are really bewildered, severely bewildered. So what to do? Or as we said the other day, Radharani said, Kim karomyaham, what shall I do? So Krishna explains what we should do in verse 28. We should engage in devotional service, finish our sinful activities, get free of all these dualities, come to the spiritual platform, the absolute platform. And if we do like that, well, then we'll reach the goal of life, we'll get out of Maya, we'll perfect our lives. You can engage in devotional service with determination. If you're still in duality, then it'll be difficult to engage in devotional service with determination. So if you get free of duality, then you can develop that ekeha kurunandana, that one-pointed type of vision. 29 is interesting. In 29, Krishna describes a fifth category of pious person who may surrender to him. Now, this is not very commonly known amongst devotees, but according to our acharyas, verse 29 is referring to what is called the Yoga Mishra Bhakta. Yoga Mishra Bhakta. Whose interest in devotional service is mixed with an interest in yoga. The Jnana Bhakta really means Jnana Mishra Bhakta. That devotee is devotional services mixed with knowledge. This is a yoga Mishra Bhakta. He has interest in Brahman, knows about Brahman. And Krishna says he's already endeavoring for liberation. But then he takes shelter. He's already endeavoring. But then he takes shelter of Krishna. So that is yoga Mishra Bhakta. And then verse 30. Well, verse 30 is also interesting. Krishna says that if you're in full consciousness of me, understanding me, fixed in knowledge of me, then you can remain fixed in Krishna consciousness, maya sakta mana, even at the time of death. Even at the time of death, which is not easy. In fact, it's the most difficult thing. There are many difficult things in this material world, and the time of death is the most difficult. But even at that time, if you're fixed in this way, then you can remember Krishna at the time of death. One other thing I want to tell you for the test is the four examples of the four personalities who very nicely exemplify the four categories of pious people who may surrender to Krishna. So the distressed person, the prime example of a distressed person who surrendered to Krishna and became successful in Krishna consciousness is anyone know? Gajendra, I guess you all know. Gajendra the elephant from the 8th canto. Now we're going to want you to give this in the test tomorrow. So distressed is Gajendra. Desirer of wealth is Dhruva Maharaj. Curious person, Shonaka. Shonaka Rishi, the head of the sages of Naimisharanya. That Sutta Goswami spoke Srimad Bhagavatam to. And the Jnana Bhaktas, chief of them is either Shukadev Goswami or the Four Kumars. So I hope you all got that. Let me just run over what the questions for the test tomorrow will be. Did you all get that, the four examples? I hope so. Four persons. So our test will include 1. The names of the 18 chapters in order. Secondly, 3 of those verses I wrote on the board. Any 3, in Sanskrit and English. Any 3, it's up to you. I gave all those verses because I consider those verses to be the most important verses. All the most important verses, in my opinion, in the first 7 chapters. No. Just do it as nicely as you can. If we see you've got the right idea, that'll be okay. 3rd is a brief description of the yoga ladder. Brief means one section on each particular part of it. So it's like, say, a couple of paragraphs. Then, the 4 classes of people who do surrender with examples and the 4 classes who don't, in English only, is sufficient. But if you want to give the Sanskrit also, or alternatively, that's okay. Then, what is explained in the last 2 verses of the 6th chapter and the first verse of the 7th chapter, What is explained, the basic message of the last 2 verses of the 6th chapter and the first verse of the 7th chapter. They all go together. So what is the basic message of those verses? Again, it should only be one sentence for each verse. Then, last, 4 examples of Duryodhana's diplomacy. There were about 6 or 7 or 8. So any 4, like his mentioning Vikarna, like Bhavan Bhishmas, Chakainascha, like that. So is that all clear?